support me. I was obliged to stop and sit down. My whole bodily machinery was utterly out of gear. I felt ready to faint. Aware of the danger, I tried, when I set out again, to distract my attention and to think of something else. I had scarcely gone 20 yards when the same recollections and their incidental results returned to the attack, and I found it impossible to shake them off. In spite of all my efforts, I do not believe that I have ever succeeded in accomplishing this journey alone without paying the penalty. I arrived at Aubonne weak, exhausted and worn out, scarcely able to stand upright. The moment I saw her, I was completely reinvigorated. By her side, I felt nothing but the importunity of an inexhaustible and ever useless vigour. On the road, within sight of Aubonne, there was a pleasant terrace called Mont Olympe, where we sometimes met. If I arrived first, I had to wait for her. How painful was this waiting! In order to divert my attention, I attempted to write notes with my pencil, which I might have written with my purest blood. I was never able to finish a single one that was legible. When she found one in the niche which we had agreed upon, all she could read in it was the truly deplorable state I was in when I wrote it. This state, and above all its continuance during 3 months of excitement and self-restraint, so exhausted me that I did not recover for several years, and finally brought on a rupture, which I shall carry with me, or which will carry me with it, into the grave. Such was the only amorous enjoyment of the man of the most inflammable temperament, but at the same time of the most retiring disposition that nature has perhaps ever produced. Such were the last happy days that have been permitted to me upon earth. I now commence the long series of the misfortunes of my life, which was seldom, if ever, interrupted. Throughout the course of my life, as has been seen, my heart, transparent as crystal, has never been able to conceal, even for a moment, any feelings at all lively which may have taken refuge in it. The reader can judge whether I found it possible to conceal for long my affection for Madame Dudatot. Our intimacy was patent to everybody. We made no secret or mystery of it. It was not of a kind to require it. And as Madame Dudatot had the tenderest friendship for me, of which she made no reproach, while I felt for her an esteem, the full justice of which no one knew better than myself, we afforded, she by her frankness, absence of mind, and thoughtlessness, I by my truthfulness, awkwardness, pride, impatience, and impetuosity, in our delusive security, more opportunity for attack than we should have done if we had been guilty. We went together to La Chevrette. We frequently met there, sometimes even by appointment. We lived there, as usual, walking alone every day while talking of our love, our duties, our friend, our innocent schemes. In the park, opposite Madame d'Epinay's apartments, beneath her windows, from which she continually watched us, and thinking herself defied, glutted her heart, by means of her eyes, with rage and indignation. All women possess the art of concealing their anger, especially when it is strong. Madame d'Epinay, who was violent but deliberate, possesses this art in an eminent degree. She pretended to see nothing, to suspect nothing, and while she redoubled her care and attention to me, and almost flirted with me, she at the same time pretended to overwhelm her sister-in-law with rudeness and marks of contempt, with which she appeared to wish to inspire me as well. It may be imagined that she did not succeed, but I was on the rack, torn by contradictory feelings, while at the same time I felt touched by her tenderness. I had difficulty in restraining my anger when I saw her wanting in respect to Madame Dudatot. The angelic gentleness of the latter enabled her to endure everything without complaining, even without resenting it. Besides, she was frequently so absent-minded, and always so little sensitive to such things, that half the time she did not even notice it. I was so taken up with my passion that, seeing nothing but Sophie—this was one of Madame Dudatot's names—I did not even notice that I had become the talk of the whole household, and of the visitors. Baron d'Holbach, who, as far as I know, had never before been to La Chevrette, was one of the latter. If I had been as mistrustful as I afterwards became, I should have strongly suspected Madame d'Epinay of arranging this visit, in order to afford him the gratification of the amusing spectacle of the amorous citizen. But at that time I was so stupid that I did not even see what was glaringly obvious to everyone. However, all my stupidity did not prevent me from finding the Baron more contented and jovial than usual. Instead of scowling at me, he discharged at me a volley of witticisms, of which I understood nothing. I opened my eyes wide, without answering. Madame d'Epinay was obliged to hold her sides to restrain her laughter. I could not make out what was the matter with them. As the limits of jest were not yet exceeded, the best thing I could have done, if I had understood, would have been to join in it. But it is true that, amidst all the Baron's mocking joviality, it was easy to perceive the light of a spiteful joy in his eyes, which would perhaps have made me uneasy, if I had noticed it as much at the time as I afterwards did when I recalled it to mind. One day, when I went to see Madame Dudeteau at Aubonne, on her return from one of her journeys to Paris, I found her sad and saw that she'd been crying. I was obliged to restrain myself, since Madame de Blainville, her husband's sister, was present. But as soon as I had a moment to myself, I told her of my uneasiness. "Ah," she said with a sigh, "I am much afraid that your follies will deprive me of all peace for the rest of my life. Saint Lambert has been informed, and wrongly informed. He does me justice, but he is annoyed, and what is worse, he does not tell me all. Happily, I have made no secret of our friendship, which was formed under his auspices. My letters, like my heart, were full of you. I have concealed nothing from him except your insensate love, of which I hope to cure you, and which, although he does not mention it, I can see that he considers a crime on my part. Someone has done us an ill turn and wronged me, but never mind. Let us either break off our acquaintance, or do you behave yourself as you ought. I do not wish to have anything more to conceal from my lover." This was the first moment when I was sensible of the shame of seeing myself humiliated through the consciousness of my offence in the presence of a young woman whose reproaches I felt to be just and whose mentor I ought to have been. The indignation which this caused me to feel against myself might perhaps have been strong enough to overcome my weakness, had not the tender compassion with which its victim inspired me again softened my heart. Alas, was that the moment to be able to harden it, when it overflowed with tears which penetrated it from all directions? This tenderness soon changed to anger against the vile informers, who had only seen the evil of a criminal but involuntary feeling, without believing or even suspecting the honourable sincerity of heart which redeemed it. We did not long remain in doubt as to the hand which had dealt the blow. We both of us knew that Madame d'Epinay corresponded with Saint Lambert. It was not the first storm which she had raised against Madame Dudeteau. She had made countless attempts to get him away from her, and the past success of some of these attempts made Madame Dudeteau tremble for the future. In addition, Grimm, who I believe had followed Monsieur de Castries to the army, was in Westphalia, as well as Saint Lambert, and they sometimes saw each other. Grimm had made some advances to Madame Dudeteau, which had been unsuccessful. This so annoyed him that he gave up visiting her. One can imagine the sang-froid with which, considering his well-known modesty, he received the supposition that she preferred a man older than himself, and of whom, since he had been admitted to the society of the great, he only spoke as his protégé. My suspicions of Madame d'Epinay became certainties when I heard what had happened at home. While I was at La Chevrette, Thérèse often came there to bring my letters or to do certain things for me, which my ill health rendered necessary. Madame d'Epinay had asked her whether Madame Dudeteau and myself corresponded, When she told me that we did, Madame d'Epinay pressed her to hand Madame Doudetot's letters to her, assuring her that she would seal them up again so cleverly that it would not be noticed. Thérèse, without letting it be seen how shocked she was at this proposal, and even without informing me, contented herself with taking greater precautions to conceal the letters which she brought me. A very wise precaution, for Madame d'Epinay had her watched when she came, and waiting for her as she passed, on several occasions carried her boldness so far as to feel in her bib. She did more. She invited herself one day, together with Monsieur de Margency, to dinner at the Hermitage for the first time since I had lived there, and took advantage of the moment when I was walking with Margency to go into my study with the mother and daughter, and begged them to show her Madame Doudetot's letters. If the mother had known where they were, they would certainly have been handed to her, but luckily only the daughter knew, and she declared that I'd not kept any of them. This was a falsehood, beyond dispute, most honourable, loyal, and generous, while to have told the truth would have been simply an act of treachery. Madame d'Epinay, seeing that she could not seduce her, attempted to rouse her jealousy by reproaching her with her good-natured and blindness. "How can you," she said to her, "fail to perceive that their connection is a criminal one? If, in spite of all you can see for yourself with your own eyes, you still want further proofs, assist in what you must do to obtain them. You say that he tears up Madame Doudetot's letters as soon as he's read them. Well, then, pick the pieces carefully and give them to me. I will put them together again." Such were the lessons which my friend gave to my companion. Thérèse had the discretion to say nothing to me for a long time about all these attempts, but at last, seeing my embarrassment, she felt bound to tell me all, so that, knowing with whom I had to deal, I might take steps to protect myself against the treachery which was intended against me. My indignation and fury were indescribable. Instead of dissembling with Madame d'Epinay, as she had done with me, and employing counterplots, I abandoned myself without restraint to my natural impetuosity, and with my usual thoughtlessness broke out openly. My imprudence may be gauged by the following letters, which sufficiently show how each of us proceeded on this occasion. Letter from Madame d'Epinay, Packet A, number 44. "What is the reason that I do not see you, my dear friend? I am uneasy about you. You promised me faithfully that you would confine yourself to going backwards and forwards from the Hermitage. Upon that I left you to do as you pleased, but no, you have let a week go by. Unless I had been told that you were well, I should think that you were ill. I expected you yesterday or the day before, but I see no signs of you. My God, what can be the matter with you? You have no business, you can have nothing to annoy you either, for I flatter myself that you would have come at once to confide in me. You must be ill, then. Relieve my anxiety immediately, I beg you. Adieu, my dear friend. May this adieu bring a good morning from you." Answer, Wednesday morning. "I cannot yet say anything to you. I am waiting until I am better informed, as I shall be sooner or later. Meanwhile, rest assured that accused innocence will find a defender sufficiently zealous to give the slanderers, whoever they may be, some cause for repentance." Second letter from Madame d'Epinay, Packet A, number 45. "Do you know that your letter alarms me? What does it mean? I've read it more than 25 times. In truth, I do not understand it. I can only learn from it that you are uneasy and tormented, and that you are waiting until you are so no longer before speaking to me about it. My dear friend, is this what we agreed? What has become of our friendship, our confidence, and how have I lost it? Are you angry with me or because of me? In any case, come this evening, I entreat you. Remember that you promised, not a week ago, to keep nothing on your mind, but to let me know of it at once. My dear friend, I rely upon that confidence. Stay, I have just read your letter again. I do not understand it any better, but it makes me tremble. You seem to me painfully agitated. I wish I could calm you, but as I do not know the reason of your uneasiness, I do not know what to say to you. except that I shall be as unhappy as yourself until I have seen you. If you are not here by 6 o'clock this evening, I shall start tomorrow for the Hermitage, whatever kind of weather it is, and whatever my state of health, for I can no longer endure this uneasiness. Good day, my dear, good friend. At all risks, I venture to tell you, without knowing whether I need do so or not, to try and take care of yourself and arrest the progress which solitude allows uneasiness to make. A fly becomes a monster. I have often experienced it. Answer, Wednesday evening. I can neither come to see you nor receive your visit, as long as my present uneasiness continues. The confidence of which you speak no longer exists, and it will not be easy for you to regain it. At present I see in your eagerness nothing but the desire of extracting from the confessions of another some advantage which may promote your views. My heart, so ready to unbosom itself to another which opens to receive it, shuts its doors in the face of slyness and cunning. I recognize your usual adroitness in the difficulty which you find in understanding my letter. Do you believe me simple enough to think that you have not understood it? No, but I shall know how to overcome your cunning by frankness. I am going to explain myself more clearly, in order that you may comprehend me still less. Two lovers, firmly united and worthy of each other's love, are dear to me. I expect that you will not understand whom I mean unless I tell you their names. I assume that attempts have been made to part them, and that I have been made use of to inspire one of them with jealousy. The choice is not very clever, but it appeared convenient for malicious purposes. And it is you whom I suspect of these designs. I hope that this makes matters clearer. So then the woman, whom I esteem above all others, with my knowledge, would have the infamy of dividing her heart and her person between two lovers, and I the disgrace of being one of these two wretches? If I knew that, for a single moment in your life, you could have entertained such thoughts of her and me, I should hate you to my dying day. But I only accuse you of having said, not of having thought it. I do not understand, in such a case, which of the three you have desired to injure. But if you love tranquillity, you should dread being so unfortunate as to succeed. I have neither concealed from you nor from her how much evil I see in certain connections, but I desire that they should be put an end to by means as honourable as the feelings which originally formed them, and that an illicit love should be changed into an eternal friendship. Should I, who never injured anyone, be made the innocent means of doing harm to my friends? No, I would never forgive you. I should become your irreconcilable enemy. Your secrets alone should be respected, for I will never be disloyal. I do not imagine that my present embarrassment can last long. I shall soon know whether I am mistaken. Then I shall perhaps have a great injury to repair, and I shall never have done anything in my life with greater goodwill. But do you know how I shall repair my errors during the short time which I have still to spend near you? By doing what no one but myself will do, by telling you frankly what the world thinks of you, and the breaches in your reputation which you have to repair. In spite of all the pretended friends by whom you are surrounded, when you see me depart, you may say farewell to truth. You will never find anyone else to tell it to you. Third letter from Madame d'Épinay. Packet A, number 46. I did not understand your letter of this morning. I told you so because it was the truth. I understand that of this evening. Do not be afraid that I shall ever answer it. I am only too anxious to forget it. And although you excite my pity, I have been unable to resist the bitterness with which it fills my soul. I employ slyness and cunning against you. I, accused of the blackest of infamies. Goodbye. I regret that you have. Goodbye. I do not know what I am saying. Goodbye. I should be only too glad to forgive you. Come when you like. You will meet with a better reception than your suspicions would entitle you to. You can spare yourself the trouble of thinking about my reputation. it matters little to me what it is. My conduct is good, that is enough for me. I may add that I am absolutely ignorant of what has happened to the two persons who are as dear to me as to you. This last letter delivered me from one terrible embarrassment and plunged me into another, which was almost as great. Although all these letters and answers had been delivered with extraordinary rapidity in the course of a single day, this interval had been long enough to allow a break in my transports of fury, and to give me time to reflect upon my monstrous imprudence. Madame Duditeau had impressed upon me, more strongly than anything else, the necessity of remaining calm, of leaving her the responsibility of extricating herself, and of avoiding, especially at the moment, all noise and actual rupture. Yet I, by the most open and monstrous insults, was on the point of completely filling with rage the heart of a woman who was already only too much inclined towards it. Naturally, I could only expect, on her part, an answer so proud, disdainful, and contemptuous, that it would leave me no alternative, unless I behaved like an utter coward, but to leave her house immediately. Happily, her cleverness was greater than my rage. She avoided, by the tone of her answer, reducing me to this extremity. But it was absolutely necessary for me either to leave the house, or to go and see her at once. One or the other was unavoidable. I decided upon the latter, feeling greatly embarrassed as to the attitude I should adopt in the explanation, which I foresaw would have to be made. How could I extricate myself without compromising Madame Duditeau or Thérèse? And woe to her whom I should name! There was nothing which the vengeance of an implacable and intriguing woman did not cause me to apprehend for her, upon whose head it might fall. It was to prevent this misfortune that I had only spoken of suspicions in my letters, to avoid being compelled to produce my proofs. It is true that this made my outbursts the more inexcusable, since no mere suspicion justified me in treating a woman, especially one who was my friend, as I had just treated Madame d'Épinay. But here commences the grand and noble task, which I have worthily fulfilled, of expiating my secret faults and weaknesses by taking upon myself the responsibility of more serious faults, of which I was incapable, and of which I never was guilty. I had not to endure the attack which I had feared, and got off with a simple fright. When I approached her, Madame d'Épinay flung her arms round my neck and burst into tears. This unexpected reception on the part of an old friend touched me greatly, and I also wept freely. I said a few words to her which did not mean much. She said a few to me which meant still less, and that was all. Dinner was served, we took our seats at the table, where, in the expectation of the explanation, which I thought was only put off until after supper, I cut a very poor figure. For I am so overcome by the slightest uneasiness which takes possession of me, that I cannot conceal it even from the most unobservant. My embarrassed manner should have inspired her with courage. However, she did not risk it. There was as little explanation after supper as before. There was none on the next day, either, and our silent tête-à-têtes were filled up with indifferent matters, or a few polite words on my part, in which, while expressing myself to the effect that I could not yet say anything about the foundation for my suspicions, I protested with all sincerity that, if they proved unfounded, my whole life would be devoted in repairing their injustice. She did not exhibit the least curiosity to know exactly what these suspicions were, or how they had occurred to me. And our reconciliation, both on her part and my own, was entirely limited to our embrace when we met. Since she alone was the injured party, at least in form, it seemed to me that it was not my business to desire an explanation which she herself did not desire, and I returned home as I'd left. In other respects, my relations with her remained unaltered. I soon almost entirely forgot the quarrel, and foolishly believed that she had forgotten it herself, because she no longer seemed to remember it. As will presently be seen, this was not the only annoyance which my own weakness brought upon me, but I also suffered others, equally annoying, which I had certainly not brought upon myself. and which were caused solely by the desire of others to tear me away from my solitude, by dint of tormenting me in it. That is to say, the desire of tearing the old woman away from it, whose services were necessary in arranging the conspiracy. It is astonishing that, during the whole of this long storm, my stupid confidence in others prevented me from understanding that it was not I, but she, whom they wanted to see in Paris again. These annoyances came upon me from Diderot and the Albachian clique. Since my establishment at the Hermitage, Diderot had never ceased to harass me, either himself or through Dallaire. And I soon saw, from the jests of the latter upon my walks in the forest, with what delight they had travestied the hermit as an amorous shepherd. But it was not a question of this in my encounter with Diderot, the cause of which was more serious. After the publication of the Fils Naturel, he had sent me a copy of it, which I had read with the interest and attention which one naturally bestows on the works of a friend. On reading the kind of poetical prose dialogue which he had added to it, I was surprised, and even somewhat saddened, to find in it, amongst several discourteous but endurable remarks directed against those who live a solitary life, the following harsh and bitter sentence, without anything to tone it down: "Only the wicked are alone." This sentence is, it appears to me, ambiguous and capable of two interpretations, one quite true, the other equally false. Since it is impossible for a man who is and who desires to be alone to be able or desirous to injure anyone, and therefore he cannot be wicked. The sentence in itself therefore required an explanation. It required it still more on the part of an author who, when he wrote the sentence, had a friend who was living in retirement and solitude. It appeared to me shocking and dishonourable that, when publishing it, he should have either forgotten this solitary friend, or that, if he had remembered him, he should not have made, at least in the general statement, the honourable and just exception which he owed not only to this friend, but to the many respected philosophers who, in all ages, have sought peace and tranquillity in retirement, and of whom, for the first time since the existence of the world, an author permits himself, by a single stroke of the pen, to make so many villains without distinction. I was tenderly attached to Diderot. I esteemed him sincerely, and I reckoned upon the same feelings on his part with perfect confidence. But, worn out by his unwearying obstinacy in eternally opposing me and my tastes, inclinations, manner of living, in fact, in everything which concerned myself alone, disgusted at seeing a man younger than myself attempting to control me absolutely like a child, sick of his readiness in making promises, and his carelessness in fulfilling them, weary of so many appointments made and broken on his part, and of his fancy for continually making fresh ones only to be broken again, tired of waiting for him in vain 3 or 4 times a month, on days fixed by himself, and of dining alone in the evening after having gone as far as Saint-Denis to meet him, after waiting for him the whole day, my heart was already full of his continued want of consideration. The last instance appeared to me more serious, and wounded me still more deeply. I wrote to him to complain of it, but with a gentleness and emotion which caused me to drench the paper with my tears. And my letter was touching enough to have drawn tears from him. No one would guess how he replied upon the matter. Here is his answer, word for word. Packet A, number 33. "I am very glad that my work has pleased you, that it has affected you. You are not of my opinion concerning hermits. Say as much good of them as you please. You will be the only one in the world of whom I shall think it. And yet I should be able to say a good deal on the matter, if I could say it to you without offending you. A woman of 80 years of age, etc. Someone has told me of a phrase from a letter of Madame d'Epinay's son, which must have pained you greatly, or else I do not know you thoroughly. I must explain the last 2 phrases of this letter. At the beginning of my stay at the Hermitage, Madame Levasseur did not seem comfortable, and appeared to find it too lonely. Her remarks on the subject were repeated to me, and I offered to send her back to Paris if she preferred it, to pay for her lodging there, and to look after her just as if she were still with me. She refused my offer, declared that she was very well satisfied with the Hermitage, and that the country air did her good, which it was easy to see was true, for she seemed to grow younger and was in far better health than at Paris. Her daughter even assured me that she would have been, on the whole, very sorry if we'd left the Hermitage, which really was a charming residence, that she was very fond of pottering about in the garden and in the orchard, of which she had the management, and that she had only said what she'd been told to say to try and induce me to return to Paris. This attempt having proved unsuccessful, they endeavoured to obtain, by appealing to my scruples, the result which my readiness to oblige had not produced. They declared that it was a crime on my part to keep the old woman there, far from the assistance which she might need at her age, without considering that she and many other old people, whose life is prolonged by the healthy air of the country, might procure this assistance from Montmorency, which was close to my doors, as if Paris had been the only place in which there were old people, and it was impossible for them to live anywhere else. Madame Levasseur, who was a large and very ravenous eater, was subject to overflows of bile and violent attacks of diarrhoea, which lasted several days and acted as a remedy. At Paris she took nothing for them, and let nature take its course. She did the same at the Hermitage, since she knew well that she could do nothing better. Never mind, because there were no physicians and apothecaries in the country, to leave her there showed a wish for her death, although she was in very good health there. Diderot ought to have fixed the age at which it is no longer permitted, under penalty of being charged with manslaughter, to allow old people to live out of Paris. This was one of the two monstrous accusations, in regard to which he made no exception in my case, in his statement that only the wicked are alone, and this was the meaning of his pathetic exclamation and the etc. which he so kindly added, a woman of 80 years of age, etc. I thought I could not reply to this reproach better than by referring to Madame Levasseur herself. I asked her to write quite simply and naturally to Madame d'Épinay, and tell her what her opinion was. To put her completely at her ease, I did not even ask to see her letter, and I showed her the following, which I wrote to Madame d'Épinay, in reference to an answer which I decided to make to a still harsher letter from Diderot, and which she had prevented me from sending. Thursday. Madame Levasseur is going to write to you, my good friend. I've asked her to tell you frankly what she thinks. To put her entirely at her ease, I have told her that I do not want to see her letter, and I beg you to tell me nothing about its contents. I will not send my letter, since you oppose it, but as I feel grievously offended, it would be a baseness and a falsehood, which I cannot permit myself, to allow that I am wrong. The gospel certainly orders him who receives a blow on one cheek to offer the other, but not to ask for pardon. Do you remember the man in the comedy who exclaims, while dealing blows with his stick, "That is the part of the philosopher"? Do not flatter yourself that you can prevent him from coming in the present bad weather. His anger will give him the time and strength which friendship refuses him, and it will be the first time in his life that he has come on the day he has promised. He will do his utmost to come and repeat with his own mouth the insults which he has heaped upon me in his letters. I will endure them with the utmost patience. He will return to Paris to be ill, and as usual I shall be a very hateful person. But what can I do? I must endure it. But can you help admiring the cleverness of this man, who wanted to come and take me in a coach to Saint-Denis to dinner, and to bring me back, and who, a week afterwards, that is packet A, number 34, finds that his finances do not allow him to visit the Hermitage except on foot? It is not absolutely impossible, to adopt his language, that this is the tone of sincerity, but in this case a strange alteration in the state of his finances must have taken place in the course of a week. I share your grief at your mother's illness, but you see that your sorrow is not nearly as great as mine. It causes less suffering to see those whom one loves ill than to see them cruel and unjust. Adieu, my good friend. This is the last time that I shall speak to you about this unfortunate affair. You speak to me of going to Paris with a coolness and indifference, which at any other time would rejoice me greatly. I informed Diderot of what I had done in regard to Madame Levasseur, at Madame d'Épinay's own suggestion, and as she chose, as may be imagined, to remain at the Hermitage, where she was very comfortable, always had company, and found her life very agreeable, Diderot, no longer knowing what crime to charge me with, construed this very precaution on my part into one, as well as Madame Levasseur's continued stay at the Hermitage, although it had been her own choice, and it had only rested, and still rested with her, to return to Paris to live, with the same assistance from me as she received at my house. Such is the explanation of the first reproach in Diderot's letter, number 33. The explanation of the second is contained in his letter, number 34. The man of letters, a name jokingly bestowed by Grimm upon Madame d'Épinay's son, must have written to you that there were 20 poor wretches on the rampart dying of cold and hunger, and waiting for the farthing you used to give them. This is a sample of our small talk, and if you were to hear the rest, it would amuse you as much as this. Here is my answer to this terrible argument, of which Diderot seemed so proud. I believe that I replied to the man of letters, that is to say, the son of a farmer general, that I did not pity the poor whom he had seen upon the rampart, waiting for my farthing, that he had apparently amply compensated them for its loss, that I had appointed him my substitute, that the poor of Paris would have no reason to complain of the exchange, but that I could not easily find an equally good one for those of Montmorency, who had much greater need of it. There is here a good and worthy old man, who, after having worked all his life, can work no longer, and is dying of hunger in his old age. My conscience is better satisfied with the 2 sous which I give him every Monday, than with the 100 farthings which I should have distributed to all the beggars on the rampart. You are amusing, you philosophers, when you regard all the inhabitants of cities as the only people with whom your duty bids you concern yourselves. It is in the country that one learns to love and serve humanity. One only learns to despise it in cities. Such were the singular scruples which led a man of intelligence to the folly of seriously making a crime of my absence from Paris, and made him attempt to prove to me, by my own example, that it was impossible for anyone to live outside the city without being wicked. At the present day I cannot understand how I was so foolish as to answer him and to feel annoyed, instead of laughing in his face as my only reply. However, Madame d'Épinay's decisions and the clamours of the Olbachian clique had so blinded people's minds in her favour that I was generally considered to be wrong in the matter, and Madame Dudatot herself, who was an enthusiastic admirer of Diderot, wanted me to go and see him in Paris and make all the first advances towards a reconciliation, which, sincere and complete as it was on my part, did not last long. The triumphant argument which she made use of to influence my heart was that Diderot, at this moment, was unhappy. Besides the storm aroused against the Encyclopédie, he had at that time to endure another, even more violent, caused by his peace, which, in spite of the little account prefixed by him at the commencement, he was accused of having taken entirely from Goldoni. Diderot, even more sensitive to criticism than Voltaire, was overwhelmed. Madame de Graffigny had even had the spitefulness to circulate the report that I had taken this opportunity to break off my acquaintance with him. I considered that it would be just and generous publicly to demonstrate the contrary, and I went to spend 2 days, not only in his company, but at his house. This was my second journey to Paris since my settlement at the Hermitage. I had taken the first in order to hasten to poor Gauffecourt, who had an attack of apoplexy, from which he has never quite recovered, during which I never left his bedside until he was out of danger. Diderot received me cordially. How many wrongs can a friend's embrace wipe out? What resentment after that can still remain in the heart? We entered into few explanations. There is no need of it in a case of mutual abuse. There is only one thing to be done, to forget it. There had been no underhand proceedings, at least as far as I knew. It was not the same as with Madame d'Épinay. He showed me the outline of the père de famille. That, said I to him, is the best defence of the fils naturel. Remain silent, work this piece out carefully, and then suddenly fling it at your enemy's head as your only reply. He did so and found the plan successful. I had sent him the first two parts of Julie nearly 6 months before, asking for his opinion of them. He had not yet read them. We read a portion of them together. He found it all feuillet. That was the word he used, meaning that it was overloaded with words and full of padding. I had already felt this myself, but it was the babbling of delirium. I have never been able to correct it. The last parts are different. The fourth especially and the sixth are masterpieces of diction. On the second day after my arrival, he insisted upon taking me to supper at Monsieur d'Holbach's. We could never manage to agree. I even wanted to break the agreement concerning the manuscript on chemistry, as I was indignant at being under an obligation for it to such a man. Diderot was completely victorious. He swore that Monsieur d'Holbach had a most sincere affection for me, that I must excuse his manner, which was the same to everybody, and from which his friends had to suffer more than anyone. He represented to me that to refuse the production of this manuscript, after having accepted it 2 years before, would be an insult to the donor, which he had not deserved, that this refusal might even be misinterpreted as a secret reproach to him for having been so long in fulfilling the agreement. "I see d'Holbach every day," he added. "I know his inner self better than you do. If you had not reason to be satisfied with it, do you think your friend capable of advising you to act meanly?" In short, with my usual weakness, I allowed myself to be overcome, and we went to supper with the Baron, who received me in his usual manner. But his wife received me coldly and almost rudely. I no longer recognized the amiable Caroline, who, before she was married, showed me so many marks of goodwill. Long before I had fancied that I perceived that, since Grimm had been a constant visitor at the house of N, I was no longer regarded with so favourable an eye. While I was in Paris, Saint-Lambert arrived on leave. As I knew nothing of it, I did not see him until after my return to the country, at first at La Chevrette, and afterwards at the Hermitage, where he came with Madame Dudateau to ask me to invite him to dinner. It may be imagined how pleased I was to receive them, but I was still more pleased to see the good understanding between them. Rejoiced that I had not disturbed their happiness, I felt happy in it myself. And I can swear that during the whole course of my mad passion, but especially at this moment, even if I had been able to take Madame Dudateau from him, I should not have wished, and I should not even have felt tempted to do so. I found her so amiable, so devoted to Saint-Lambert, that I could hardly imagine that she might have been equally devoted in her love for myself. And without desiring to disturb their union, all that I had most truly desired from her in my delirium was that she should allow herself to be loved. In short, however violent the passion with which I had been inflamed for her, I felt it as delightful to be the confidant as the object of her affections. And I have never for a moment regarded her lover as my rival, but always as my friend. It will be said that this was not yet actual love. So be it. But then it was more. As for Saint-Lambert, he behaved honourably and judiciously. As I was the only guilty party, I alone was punished, and that even mercifully. He treated me severely, but amicably, and I saw that I'd lost something of his esteem, but nothing of his friendship. I consoled myself, since I knew that it would be easier for me to regain the former than the latter, and that he was too sensible to confound an involuntary and momentary weakness with a radical vice. If, in all that had taken place, there had been errors on my part, they were trifling ones. Was it I who had sought his mistress? Was it not he who had sent her to me? Was it not she who had sought me? Could I have avoided seeing her? What could I do? They alone had done the mischief, and I had been the one to suffer from it. In my place he would have done just as I did, perhaps worse. For, in short, however faithful, however estimable Madame Dudetome may have been, she was a woman. He was very often absent. The opportunities were frequent. The temptations were great. And it would have been very difficult for her always to defend herself with equal success against a more enterprising lover. It was certainly a great thing for her and for me, in such a situation, that we had been able to fix the limits, which we never permitted ourselves to overstep. Although, in the bottom of my heart, I could produce sufficiently honourable testimony in my favour, appearances were so much against me that the unconquerable feeling of shame, by which I was always dominated, gave me, in his presence, the appearance of a guilty person, and he often abused it in order to humiliate me. A single incident will make our mutual relations clear. After dinner I read to him the letter which I had written to Voltaire the year before, and which he had heard spoken of. He went to sleep while I was reading it, and I, formerly so proud, now so foolish, did not venture to discontinue reading, and read on while he snored. Thus did I humble myself, thus did he avenge himself. But his generosity never permitted him to do so, except when we three were alone. After he went away again, I found Madame Dudetot greatly altered in her behaviour towards me. I was as surprised as if I ought not to have expected it. I was more affected by it than I ought to have been, and this caused me much suffering. It seemed that everything by which I expected to be cured only plunged deeper into my heart the arrow which I had at length rather broken off than pulled out. I was resolved to conquer myself completely, and to leave nothing undone to change my foolish passion into a pure and lasting friendship. With this object I had formed the most admirable plans in the world, which I needed Madame Dudetot's assistance in carrying out. When I attempted to speak to her, I found her absent and embarrassed. I felt that she had ceased to feel any pleasure in my society, and I saw clearly that something had taken place which she did not want to tell me, and which I have never learnt. This change, of which I was unable to obtain an explanation, tortured me cruelly. She asked me to return her letters. I returned them all, with a fidelity which, to my great mortification, she for a moment doubted. This doubt was another unexpected pang for me, as she must have well known. She did me justice, but not immediately. I understood that the examination of the packet which I had returned to her had made her conscious of her injustice. I even saw that she reproached herself, and this gave me a certain advantage again. She could not take back her own letters without returning mine. She told me she'd burnt them. In my turn I ventured to doubt it, and I confess that I doubt it still. No, one does not throw such letters into the fire. The letters in Julie have been considered burning. Good heavens, what would have been thought of mine? No, no, a woman capable of inspiring such a passion will never have the courage to burn the proofs of it. But neither do I fear that she has ever misused them. I do not believe her capable of it. And besides, I had taken measures to prevent it. The foolish but lively fear of being ridiculed had made me commence this correspondence in a tone which protected the contents of my letters from being communicated to others. I even carried the familiar tone which I adopted in them so far as to thee and thou her, but in such a manner that she certainly could not have been offended. Certainly she complained of it several times, but without success. Her complaints only aroused my suspicions, and besides, I could not bring myself to draw back. If these letters are still in existence, and should one day see the light, it will be known how I have loved. The pain which Madame Dudetot's coldness caused me, and the certainty that I had not deserved it, caused me to take the singular course of complaining about it to Saint Lambert himself. While waiting to see the result of my letter on the subject, I plunged into the distractions to which I ought to have had recourse sooner. Some festivities took place at La Chevrette, for which I composed the music. The pleasure of distinguishing myself in the eyes of Madame Dudetot, by the display of a talent which she admired, spurred my energies. And another circumstance contributed to arouse them, namely the desire of showing that the author of the Divin du Village understood music. For I had long since perceived that someone was secretly working to make this seem doubtful, at least in regard to composition. My first appearance in Paris, the tests to which I had there been subjected on different occasions, at Monsieur Dupin's and Monsieur de la Poplinière's, the quantity of music which I had composed during 14 years in the midst of the most famous artists, under their very eyes. And lastly, the opera of the Muse Galante, even that of the Divin, a motet which I had written for Mademoiselle Fell, and which she had sung at the Spiritual Concert, the numerous discussions on this beautiful art which had taken place between myself and its greatest masters. All these proofs should have prevented or dissipated any such doubt. It existed, however, even at La Chevrette, and I saw that Monsieur d'Épinay was not free from it. Without appearing to be aware of it, I undertook to compose a motet for him for the dedication of the chapel of La Chevrette, and I asked him to supply me with words chosen by himself. He commissioned Delinant, his son's tutor, to write them. Delinant composed some words suitable to the occasion, and a week after they were given to me, the motet was finished. This time, spite was my Apollo, and never did richer music leave my hands. The words began with, Ecce sedes hic tonantis. I have since heard that these words were by de Santeuil, and that Monsieur de Lina had quietly appropriated them. The pomp of the opening was in keeping with the words, and the whole motet was so beautiful that everyone was struck with admiration. I had written for a large orchestra. D'Épinay got together the best instrumentalists. Madame Bruna, an Italian singer, sang the motet, and was excellently accompanied. The motet was so successful that it was afterwards given at the Spiritual Concert, at which, in spite of the secret intrigues and the poorness of the execution, it was twice heartily applauded. For Monsieur d'Épinay's birthday, I supplied the idea of a kind of piece, half-drama, half-pantomime, which Madame d'Épinay composed, and for which I also wrote the music. Grimm, on his arrival, heard of my musical successes. An hour later, nothing more was said about them. But at any rate, as far as I know, there was no longer any question of my knowledge of composition. No sooner was Grimm at La Chevrette, where already I was not very comfortable, than he made my stay completely unendurable by putting on airs, which I had never seen exhibited by anyone before, and of which I had not even an idea. The day before his arrival I was turned out of the best visitor's room, which I was occupying, next to Madame d'Épinay's. It was got ready for Grimm, and another, in a more remote part of the house, was given to me. See, said I to Madame d'Épinay with a laugh, see how the newcomers turn out the old. She appeared embarrassed, and I understood the reason for this better in the evening, when I learned that, between her room and that which I was leaving, there was a secret door of communication, which she had not thought it worth while to show me. Her relations with Grimm were no secret to anybody, neither in her own house nor in public, nor even to her husband. However, far from admitting it to me, her confidant in secrets of far greater importance, and which she knew were perfectly safe with me, she stoutly denied it. I understood that this reserve was due to Grimm, who, although he was the depository of all my secrets, was unwilling that I should have any of his own in my keeping. However much my former feelings, which were not yet extinguished, and the man's real merits prejudiced me in his favour, these feelings were not proof against the efforts he took to destroy them. He received me in the style of the Comte de Touffière, one of the characters in Le Gloria, a comedy by Destouches, 1732. He hardly condescended to return my greeting. He never addressed a single word to me, and soon cured me of addressing any to him by never answering me at all. He took precedence everywhere and held first place, without ever paying any attention to me. I could have let that pass if he had not displayed an offensive affectation. A single incident out of 1,000 will explain what I mean. One evening, Madame d'Epinay, feeling slightly unwell, told the servants to bring her something to eat upstairs to her room, where she intended to have her supper by the side of the fire. She asked me to go upstairs with her, which I did. Grimm came up afterwards. The little table was already laid, but only for two. Supper was brought in. Madame d'Epinay took her seat on one side of the fire. Monsieur Grimm took an easy chair, settled himself in the other corner, drew up the little table between them, unfolded his napkin, and proceeded to eat, without saying a single word to me. Madame d'Epinay blushed, and to induce him to apologize for his rudeness, offered me her own place. He said nothing, and did not even look at me. As I was unable to get near the fire, I decided to walk up and down the room until they brought me a plate. At last he allowed me to sup at the end of the table, away from the fire, without making the slightest apology to me, his senior, in ill health, an older acquaintance of the family, who had introduced him to the house, the honours of which he ought even to have shown to me, as the favourite of the lady of the house. All his behaviour to me was very much after the same pattern. He did not treat me exactly as his inferior. He looked upon me as a perfect nonentity. I found it hard to recognise the former cuistre, who, in the Prince of Saxe-Gotha's establishment, felt himself honoured by a look from me. I found it still harder to reconcile this profound silence and this insulting haughtiness with the tender friendship which he boasted he entertained from me, in the presence of these who he knew entertained it for me themselves. It is true that he rarely gave any signs of it, except to sympathise with my pecuniary position, of which I never complained, or to compassionate my melancholy lot, with which I was quite content, or to lament that I so harshly rejected the beneficent attentions which he declared he was eager to show me. It was by artifices like this that he caused his tender generosity to be admired, my ungrateful misanthropy to be censured, and imperceptibly accustomed everyone to imagine that the relations between a protector like himself and an unfortunate creature like me could only be, on the one side, benefits, and on the other, obligations, without supposing, even as a remote possibility, a friendship between two equals. As for myself, I have vainly tried to discover in what respect I could be under an obligation to this new patron. I had lent him money. He had never lent me any. I had nursed him during his illness. He hardly ever came to see me during mine. I had introduced him to all my friends. He had never introduced me to one of his. I had sung his praises with all my might. If he sang my praises, it was less publicly and in quite a different manner. He has never rendered or even offered to render me any service of any kind. How, then, was he my Maecenas? How was I his protégé? This was beyond my powers of comprehension, and it still remains so. It is true that, more or less, he was arrogant with everybody, but with no one so brutally as with myself. I remember that, on one occasion, Saint-Lambert was on the point of throwing his plate at his head, when he ventured to give him the lie publicly at table, by saying rudely, "That is not true." To his naturally sarcastic tone he united the conceit of an upstart, and his continual impertinence even made him ridiculous. Intercourse with great people had led him to assume airs which one only sees in the least sensible amongst them. He never summoned his lackey except with an "Eh!" as if my fine gentleman did not know which of his numerous attendants was on duty. When he gave him a commission to execute, he threw the money on the ground instead of putting it into his hand. At last, forgetting altogether that he was a man, he treated him with such disgusting contempt and cruel disdain on every occasion that the poor lad, who was a very good fellow, whom Madame d'Epinay had given him, left his service, without any other cause of complaint than the impossibility of enduring such treatment. He was the La Fleur of this new Glorieux, as foppish as he was vain, with his large, dull eyes and his flabby face. He pretended to have great success with the ladies, and, after his farce with Mademoiselle Fell, he was considered by numbers of the fair sex to be a man of deep feeling. This had made him the fashion, and had given him a taste for feminine neatness. He began to play the dandy. His toilet became a serious matter. Everybody knew that he made up, and I, who at first refused to believe it, began to be convinced not only by his beautiful complexion, and by the fact of finding some pots of cosmetic on his dressing-table, but because one morning, on entering his rooms, I found him brushing his nails with a little brush made for the purpose, an occupation which he proudly continued in my presence. I argued that a man who could spend 2 hours every morning in brushing his nails might very well employ a few minutes in filling up the wrinkles in his skin with cosmetic. The worthy Gophercor, who was no fool, had humorously nicknamed him Tigrin le Blanc. All this was merely ridiculous, but very antipathetic to my character, and at last made me suspicious of his. I could scarcely believe that a man whose head was so turned could have his heart in the right place. He prided himself more than anything else upon his sensibility of soul and vigorous energy of feeling. How did that agree with those defects which are peculiar to little minds only? How could the lively and continuous flights, which a feeling heart takes in pursuit of things outside it, allow him time to busy himself with such petty